Welcome to a podcast from the Irish Linen Centre and Lisburn Museum. My name's Kieran. I'm joined by James Fraser, a research officer. And tonight we have Ken Dawson, who's in to speak about Henry Munro, 1798, and Lisburn. I suppose we'll start at the start and ask you a wee bit about yourself and how you got into the line of work that you're doing now.
Okay. Well, I've just retired from teaching and I was a teacher for 32 years in Down High School as a history teacher and then as head of department and vice principal. And I really have to say I knew very little about the 18th century until I went there, and my wonderful head of department, sadly, the late Margaret Curry, brought me down to the grave of Thomas Russell, which is a couple of hundred yards from the front gate of the school. Mm-hmm. And it was part of the A-level course, and so I eventually got an opportunity to teach this fascinating period of Irish history, and I then began to research it and started to publish things and so on. So mm-hmm. It's very much a hobby, as much as it ever was a job.
But you turned that hobby, like you published a book on Samuel Neeson. Can you tell us a wee bit about that process, how that came together?
Yeah, well, I think a few of us in and around the Ballinahinch and Sainfield area mm-hmm. had always felt that there were people within the United Irish narrative who had never quite been exploited or explored fully. And in 1998, a group of us under the title The Hearts of Down had published a series of essays on 1798 in County Down. Right. So we were absolutely thrilled to have people like Thomas Bartlett and A.T.Q. Stewart contribute to that book, as well as a range of local historians led by Dr. Brian Turner from Down County Museum. And part of the discussion there was looking at Belfast, and I'm originally from Belfast, and so my focus really tended to be to be there. And Samuel Neeson was always somebody that I felt was undervalued in a sense, and yet he's there at the very start of the United Irish journey in 1791. In many respects, he was the person who was the founder of the Society of United Irishmen, although we tend to think of Tone. I think people like Drennan and Neeson certainly were absolutely fundamental to the formation of the Society of the United Irishmen. Mm-hmm. Neeson was also editor of the Northern Star, which was the propaganda organ of the United Irish Society. And as well as that, he is responsible, in my view, of accelerating the trend from constitutionalism towards a more militant form, particularly after the outbreak of war with France in 1793, when suddenly the pro-French proclivities of the Irish, of the United Irishmen, become seditious and dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and James, myself and James were talking about this earlier. I mean, how do you balance putting together a book while working, you know, stressful, I'm sure, difficult job? I mean, that's quite a balancing act.
Yeah, and I suppose the simple answer, actually, Kieran and James, is that it took a very long time. Because I tended to do all my research during holiday times.
Okay.
And that was generally July, and particularly during the years as a vice principal, I was back to school in August. Mm-hmm. So it really was concertinaed into a month and a long process over a number of years that takes you to London, to the National Archives at Kew, or to Edinburgh for the records there, because Neeson had been a prisoner in Fort George from 1799 to 1802, and then obviously to the National Archives in Dublin. So there were plenty of trips to London and Dublin for my wife and I, and it's really just a case of building up from there. And of course, the Public Records Office in Belfast and the Linen Hall Library are absolutely wonderful repositories. So a lot of time spent there. But yeah, it should have really been published earlier, but such was the nature of the job, which I loved.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll forgive
you. It was very much a summer thing.
it was a bit of a labour of love then. And there seems to be an increasing trend, a movement out there towards a growing interest in 1798 and the characters and the history of that area, of that era. I don't know if you want to speak a wee bit about that. What is it that's captured? I think it's in the last maybe 5-6 years. There's more walking tours, there's more talks, there's more books, there's just a general sort of focus on that period.
Yeah, I think there's something really interesting about the 18th century in the sense that it's quite idiosyncratic. And nowadays there's a sort of binary unionism, nationalism narrative. And in the 18th century, you've got the Age of Enlightenment, you've got questioning, you've got the interrogation of the old ways of doing things, you've got the electrifying impacts of the revolution in America and also in France. And all of those things have a resonance, not just here in Ireland, but elsewhere across Europe. And so I think you've got this sort of, you know, this coalition of really interesting Atlantic initiatives. But you also have a general questioning of the old way of doing things. And one of the things I'll be referring to tonight, for example, is Henry Monroe's membership of the Freemasons. And I think the Freemasons themselves, while politics was meant to be a non-starter in the Freemasons' lodge room, there was a sense in which the construction of the perfect society was something that the Freemasons were involved in. And you can still see that in the imagery of the... you know, the American nation, from banknotes to the ideas of leading founding fathers and Freemasons like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison.
Yeah, I wonder if I'm just, this is an idea, are people trying to use the history of 1798 to do and look at the politics of today? Are they trying to, well, not look into the 19th century, but maybe in the 18th century there's something that bit more of a utopia that we could kind of look towards to get some sort of a deal out of?
Yeah, I think that's very much the case. I mean, it is enlightenment. It is a questioning of the old orthodoxies and certainties. And I think there is a sense in which the 18th century is a more safe space for people. And you can almost take risks as a citizen or as a historian or as a student or as a teacher because the period is so interesting. I was at a conference in Belfast in Clifton House quite recently on Theobald Wolfe Tone. And I think certainly in academic circles, the sense would be a pessimism almost, in the sense that courses on the 18th century are not being followed as much in schools in Northern Ireland, where the preponderance is the 20th century, and also at university. But I think outside of the academic world, if you like, there's a sort of groundswell of interest in 1790. I don't do social media, but I know that there are a number of Facebook groups and so on that are promoting interest in not just what happened in 98, but also how it's been remembered and disremembered. And a lot of that goes back to the writings of Guy Byner, who wrote this wonderful book, Forgetful Remembrance. And Minor is looking at how people like Henry John McCracken have been interpreted, reinterpreted, misinterpreted, forgotten, disremembered, over the last 200 years, and I think Monroe falls into that category as well. And I think for people living in the 21st century with all of the complexities of the modern world, I think the 18th century is quite an interesting place, and it's full of little quirks as well. You know, for example, the Orange Order. Which was founded in 1795, was neutral on the Act of Union, and many members of the Orange Order across Ireland were actually strongly opposed to the Act of Union. And again, that just doesn't seem to make sense in today's world. The Catholic Church broadly in favour of the Union, and again, it was felt that there was a better chance of reform, be that greater entitlements, Catholic emancipation, the right to sit in Parliament, and so on, under a Union Parliament, than there would have been under the old Irish Parliament, which of course was the preserve of the Protestant aristocracy.
Yeah, okay.
So I think, you know, it's just interesting and quirky. I think the fact that 1798 saw so many Presbyterians turn out in Antrim and Down has been an object of fascination for many people who are Presbyterian, as much as it's been something disremembered. And I think there's always been a sort of pride, a secret pride perhaps, you know, about the pike and the thatch and so on.
Henry Monroe then, Ken, where does he fit into all this that we've been discussing so far? And maybe you could tell us a bit about his links to Lisburn on the linen industry.
Sure. Well, Henry Monroe fits in very briefly, I think would be the first thing that I would say, James, because one of the first points I'll make tonight is that Henry Monroe's revolutionary career, if you like, lasts barely a week. He almost comes from obscurity, and he actually goes back into obscurity because he's not one of those very well-known figures who sit at the top table of the United Irish memory, the United Irish myth. So he is a Lisburn man. He has a linen shop and business in Market Square, just opposite where we are now, the old market house, now the museum. He lives there, he works there, and he is executed opposite there. So Munro is a traveller. He is a linen draper, and that takes him to Belfast, it takes him to Lurgan, to Tandragee. You know, he's very much familiar with the Linen Triangle. He's also associated with the Volunteers, which emerged in the 1770s, initially to protect Ireland from the potential of a French invasion during the American War, when many of the troops had gone to fight in the colonies. He's also a Freemason. He's an early subscriber to the Northern Star newspaper. And he joins the United Irishmen in 1795, but he actually leaves very little trace behind. And you know, if Munro lived in the 21st century, would probably say he leaves no digital imprint. He's very, very obscure. He's hard to find information on, and so, you know, we don't know that much on Munro. So any nuggets you do find in the archives, you tend to sort of celebrate and sort of, you know, jump for joy, because he is quite an unknown. There's no obvious record of him within the military structures of the United Irishmen. That's not to say he didn't have a role, but certainly we don't have any informer reports, for example, telling us that Henry Munro was at a meeting of the United Irishmen in Saintfield or in Randallstown or anything like that. And he emerges in 1798 largely because there is a complete dearth, there's an absence of leadership in County Down after the arrest of the Adjutant General for that country, who was the Reverend Steele Dixon of Portaferry, a Presbyterian minister. And so the point that I'll be making tonight is that Munro, who does have a knowledge of military matters, even though he had never fired a shot in anger, is basically headhunted. And he is probably flattered to be asked. And he goes to Saintfield, he takes command of the United Irish forces, he moves them to Ballinahinch, and he fights this last-ditch rearguard action against the forces of General Nugent on the 13th of June. He's court-martialed here in Lisburn. It's one of the shortest court-martial papers that you find in the National Archives in Dublin. He's also the first of the significant figures to be court-martialed and executed on the 16th of June. Just days after the Battle of Ballinahinch. And in fact, at his court-martial, Munro expresses contrition for what he did. So, you know, I'll make the point tonight that, you know, Henry John McCracken in Belfast was somewhat fanatical in terms of his membership of the United Irishmen, and Henry Munro is more contrite and almost apologetic in the end. I think he felt that he was doing the duty that was being asked of him. But there is evidence to suggest that he was certainly a United Irishman in Lisburn. He had, according to Catherine Templeton, who is his sister-in-law, she's married to John Templeton, the famous botanist in Belfast. Catherine Templeton tells us that Munro had actually been appointed as a colonel in the United Irish military structure in County Armagh, but we know very little or nothing about that. And Armagh was not at the forefront of activity in the summer of 1798.
Is there an issue with sources, or is material surviving, or the poor record keeping, or what?
I suppose a combination of all three. When Munro was captured, it actually took a couple of days for the authorities to know who Munro was. Initially, it was felt that Hamill Moore from Killinchy was the leader, and obviously there had been a miscommunication there. And once it became clear that it was Munro and he had been arrested, then his papers were confiscated and destroyed. So in the absence of personal papers, what you're left with is, you know, a very intricate jigsaw puzzle, but without the picture.
Okay.
To construct it.
Yeah, okay. James, you had an interesting question that we debated somewhat beforehand. I said, I'm not asking that question.
Yeah. Do you believe his ghost haunts this building? I don't know whether you've heard the story before.
I have heard the story. I think Trevor, who we spoke to earlier, did mention that going back many a year. I think I said to you, I'm at a talk tomorrow night about Gill Hall, and it's famously haunted. And Henry Monroe's ghost is said to inhabit the building. Yeah, I don't know whether either of you guys have encountered the ghost of Henry Monroe. Well,
I'm here not too long, so maybe I'll see him shortly.
Yeah, I've been here 11 years, and I've walked through this building in the darkness and at different times of night, and I haven't seen a thing. So I'm very skeptical.
Well, maybe if there's a power cut during the talk tonight,
maybe
somebody's trying to tell us something, or maybe he said that's not what happened to me.
I mean, if he's haunting another place, I mean, that's a very busy ghost. You know, that's how does he divide himself? So yeah, you were talking earlier about your links, your job in Downpatrick, your links to the museum there. So I was going to ask you a question. So based on this work you've done, if we were to say, right, Ken, tomorrow I want you to start working on an exhibition, pulling material together, I mean, where would you start? What would you like to feature? I noticed in your presentation you have Monroe jugs. I mean, would there be any other objects you'd be interested in seeing?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the volunteering tradition was very active here in the Lisburn area, in Derriachie, in Lambeg, in Ballanderry, and of course here in Lisburn. And there are actually a number of volunteer companies in Lisburn. A historian called TGF Patterson a number of years ago detailed the different volunteer companies in the town, and his work has been enduring but also invaluable for anybody following on. So certainly, you know, perhaps belt plates or something like that from the volunteer period would be particularly interesting. And I think as well as that, sometimes it's really illuminating to see copies of some of the original documents. So for example, as part of the presentation this evening, there'll be an extract from Henry Monroe's court martial, and that lies in the National Archives in Dublin. You know, it's a very short document. As I said, it's a very quick court martial. There were only three witnesses, all of whom basically identified Monroe as the person who was in charge of the United Irish Army of around about 6,000 at Ballinahinch. He not just said that he was chosen, in a sense, by one of the emissaries who were out circulating around the countryside, a fella called James Townsend. He basically said, you know, I was told to act by James Townsend. And Monroe even offers to provide any information that might quieten the country. Okay. You know, so that's quite a remarkable admission, in a sense, during a court martial. So I think original documents would be particularly useful. We have no image of Monroe. You know, there's no portrait, there's no likeness. There is only one, a Thomas Rawlinson print, which is pretty ubiquitous, and it's what everybody goes to in terms of this is Henry Monroe. Yeah. But we have the portraits of McCracken, Tone, even Nielsen, Thomas Addis Emmett, Robert Emmett, but we don't have anything like that on Henry Monroe. And I think that's a shame, but I think those sort of visual impressions are very useful. And I think something else that is important. I know the museum here in Lisburn has just you know, completed a fantastic exhibition on Lisburn Cathedral. Monroe was an Anglican, which certainly in Ulster was unusual for somebody who was turning out in 1798. And I think some of the records from the cathedral would be particularly useful. And of course, as a linen draper, you know, there's no shortage of material and sources that give us a sense of the type of Lisburn that Henry Monroe was inhabiting in the 1770s, 1780s, and 1790s.
Brilliant. Okay, so what's next then? You're speaking tonight in Henry Monroe and Lisburn. I mean, what's on the horizon? Are you working on a publication or?
Yeah, I'd started doing a write-up on Monroe, and that really is looking at Monroe and the overall context of County Down, and takes you to the Battle of Ballinahinch and so on. And that ground has been covered to a degree by wonderful historians like A.T.Q. Stewart and his Summer Soldiers that was published, I think, back in 1994. But I just felt that there was enough in Monroe that you can find. And I think there's a little bit more to be said. So I'm hoping to write something on that.
Fantastic.
But as somebody who's just retired from Down High School, which is 90 years old, I'm also involved in a really exciting history project there to celebrate the illuminating and the wonderful history of the school.
Mm-hmm.
And its people and its teachers and its community.
Brilliant. I'm sure I'll keep you busy. James, I'm not sure if you have any follow-up questions. If you don't, I don't know about you. I'm looking forward to the talk now.
Yeah, looking forward to it, Ken.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
fascinating. Been great. Yeah.